Hello and welcome back to yet another episode of the VC Bruner podcast, a podcast that provides a unique perspective of the startup world through the lens of venture capitalists and entrepreneurs. I'm your host Digjay, and today I have with me Vaibhav Domkundwar, founder and CEO at Better Capital, an early stage venture firm that has a strong portfolio of 80 plus companies, which includes well-known startups like Khatabook, OpenBank, Jupiter, Rupeek, Testbook, Yulu, and many more. Vaibhav is an entrepreneur turned investor and has founded two companies, a venture-backed startup called Roamware, which was later acquired by private equity firm Audax, and Better, a self-financed startup studio that has now evolved into an early-stage venture firm. In today's episode, Vaibhav talks about his path to angel investing, evaluating founders at early-stage startups, building leverage as a founder, bootstrapping versus fundraising, and how one should build his or her brand as a first-time angel investor. I had a great time talking to Vaibhav, and I hope you enjoy this conversation too. So without much ado, let's jump in and listen to what Vaibhav has to share. Hi Vaibhav, welcome to the VC Pruner podcast. Very excited to have you on the show with us.
Hey Digjay, thank you for doing this, and it's a pleasure.
Okay, great. So let's start off with a brief background about yourself, you know, before we jump into the questions and know more about yourself and your journey in venture capital.
Yep. Look, I think I've been an entrepreneur for life. I went to Berkeley in the mid 90s when Netscape was going public, and I got immersed into technology, having never really touched a computer until then, until I graduated from India. I think those were the two best years of my life in terms of crazy immersion around technology, around Silicon Valley, around Berkeley itself, which has a mind of its own. And I think they were very transformative for me personally, because it just helped me think in a very analytical fashion without constraints, because you sort of grow up in India with a very constrained view of the world. At least that was the case in the 80s and 90s when I grew up, right? Dramatically different today, thankfully. So that was amazing. And then I essentially, you know, late 90s, so everybody with a heartbeat in the Bay Area had an idea. And so did I. So that's what led to my entrepreneurial journey. I essentially built two companies in my life. Roamware was the first one, which I did with about four other co-founders. Classic Silicon Valley formula, raised a bunch of capital, got great timing in the worst way, because we started in year 2000. But thanks to all my co-founders as well, that we figured out a very interesting niche and built Roamware into a category leader, and eventually exited to a PE firm called Audax. The second company is Better, where we started as a startup studio and quickly evolved into sort of running a set of operating businesses, and then kind of taking all those learnings into investments, and then kind of starting the Better Capital chapter from Jan 2018. So we're pretty much completing 3 years as we speak today. So that's kind of the long and short of it, and can't be more excited for where we are today in the Indian venture capital ecosystem and startup ecosystem and what lies ahead.
Yeah, and you've timed your return to India perfectly as well. And there's a lot to unpack in those 2 or 3 decades, you know, that you just described. And before we jump into, you know, knowing more about Better Capital, tell me what's the best part about, you know, working as an early stage investor, working with entrepreneurs all the time?
Look, I think I'll be speaking for a lot of my friends when I say that there comes a time when you think the founders you are meeting have just incredibly greater hustle than you ever had in your entrepreneurial career, right? And I'm pretty sure my friends in the Valley will also say that, right? When I saw that, I just felt that, you know, I just want to be part of so many of these journeys, right? And I think being an operator for 20 years, being very hands-on all these years, it sort of makes you wonder how much impact you can potentially bring by being an active investor. And I think that's really the gist of where I am and why I'm doing this.
Awesome. So tell us more about, you know, Better Capital, the thesis, you know, the investment model and the kind of portfolio that you've built, you know, over the last 2, 2.5 years.
Yeah. So look, I think at a high level, Better Capital is a pre-seed and seed stage focused fund. We essentially do 50K to 300K checks in Indian companies building for India and Indian companies building for the world. And ideally want to partner with founders as early as we can. We're not looking for anybody else or any outside signal for building our conviction. So we're kind of going into ideas, going into discovering opportunities with founders at the very early stages. And I think that's what we want to be. We want to be sort of the first check into the largest number of companies that are founded in India, because that's where my heart is, right? So I've been kind of a 0-1 person. I'll probably really suck at anything beyond that, right? So might as well, you know, what I tell the founders, right? Scale what you are best at. What's your superpower? So I think my superpower within my own constraints is essentially really doing pre-seed and that stage and sort of, you know, bringing more ideas to life, right? So that's what Better Capital is. Very sector agnostic. I think we're very early in the Indian startup ecosystem evolution. So I feel there's a tremendous opportunity in unpacking the fintech opportunity, edtech, SaaS, agri. I think gaming will be very, very large in India personally. So I think we're taking a sector agnostic approach to being early with some of the best teams in the country.
Right. And you spoke about, you know, being sector agnostic, and was just going through your website, you've made close to 80 investments now across a range of sectors that you just mentioned. So how do you think about portfolio strategy, you know, even when investing in pre-seed startups? Is there a specific percent in mind, or is there a way that you think in terms of, you know, allocating capital to specific sectors?
So I'm sort of taking a first principles approach to this, right? So from a venture perspective, let's say I am an outsider starting fresh in venture. So when I do that, I think my view is very simple. Obviously, there are a whole bunch of models, right? There's a legacy model of venture capital, and there's a lot of merit to a ton of things that's there. But then there's a lot of evolution of ideas as well that is happening at a faster pace than it has ever happened in the last 30, 40 years. And I think I probably fall in that bucket because I think the question I'm asking is, do I want to own a small chunk of Open or Rupeek or Khata Book or Swiggy or something like that? And I think the answer is, that's essentially what I want to do, and at the earliest stages, right? So I think we're just keeping that in mind. We're not saying I want a percentage ownership as a restriction for us to do an investment. Right. So we're sort of agnostic to constraining ourselves based on ownership. At the same time, what happens is, you know, if we are leading a bunch of pre-seed rounds, we end up sort of in the ownership range that we're comfortable with. But at the same, you know, we are part of rounds which, you know, change from being $500,000 to $1 million to about $3 or $4 million rounds just because of how things move. And in which case, obviously, I think our check size is much smaller and our ownership is smaller. We're very comfortable with that because I think the conviction is in the founding team and the market opportunity. And we want to be part of that journey. And I think the way we are structured, it allows us to really kind of operate in this way in a very flexible fashion.
Right. And how do you think about distributing your capital across different sectors? So how much capital you want to allocate, you know, to fintech, to B2B SaaS or edtech? So how do you look at sector allocation as well?
Yeah, so look, I'll kind of zoom out a little bit just to give you a perspective of how we are structured, right? Because I think that will be very important to answer this question correctly. So unlike a venture fund model that has existed so far, wherein, let's say I raise a $50 million fund and I sort of figure out allocation across stages or sectors and follow-ons and pro-ratas and whatnot, we are actually structured as a SPV-based fund, right? So what I call as an open fund, which means, you know, we are not a train that is starting and completing a certain journey in a certain time. And that's why I have to pace myself and do this. We are actually, you know, 80 trains that are leaving the station or X number of trains that are leaving the station every year, right? And I think we are not saying that train one is going to pay for train five and train 10 has to pay for all these other trains because, you know, they are not reaching on time or they are failing in the middle or something like that, right? So our model essentially allows us to evaluate opportunities, sectors, and timing in certain sectors fairly independent of what we've done in the past. So from that perspective, we sort of have the flexibility of taking any number of bets in a sector as long as we are sort of convinced about the opportunity. Just like I think Y Combinator does, right? I don't think they're constraining themselves by saying that, oh, we've done enough of food tech, so let's not do any more food tech, correct?
Yep.
That kind of a thing. So I think we're structured in a very similar fashion, which again, I think goes back to how I thought of building Better Capital in the first place. And I think 3 years into it, it still feels like it satisfies what I'm trying to build.
Very interesting. And that's a great analogy to, you know, explain the SPV model, comparing that with the, you know, typical venture fund model. And it's kind of democratizing, you know, venture investing in general, angel investing in general. I want to, you know, talk more about the decision-making framework and how you evaluate deals. And while you're investing at pre-seed levels, there's very limited data point that you have. So one of the important factors that you have to rely on is the founder quality. So the question is, how do you evaluate the founders, you know, that early before making the investment decision? And what do you particularly look for in these founders?
Yeah. So I think important thing for me for founder quality has been grit, right? So it's very hard to explain that word because it's very subjective. It can take different forms in different situations for different people. And unfortunately, it's a very hard one to judge as well. So what I'm looking for is sort of signals that help me understand the grittiness of a founder, right? Because I'm unfortunately or fortunately a market first investor. Once I believe in the market, and maybe because I've been an operator, right? I've sold all over the world. I have done my own SEO. I have done sequence emails. I have converted. So you just feel that if I can touch and feel the market, I can see the signal, then I'll figure it out with the team. So, and when I'm in that situation, then I just want to see that grittiness. I want them to tell me that they will never run out of the money. They will never give up. And never as in, you know, we're not going to be stupid about it, but, you know, kind of give it all. And you know, it's not really that hard to not fail. It is hard to succeed. And it is hard to succeed like an Airbnb and a DoorDash, but it is not very hard not to fail. And that's kind of at ground zero. I'm just saying, look, I love the market. I love you guys. And I love the grit. So once that comes together, then I think it becomes very quick, right? So I've done some very, very quick decisions, which have been some of our best investments as well. And unfortunately, it's a very unscientific decision, or fortunately. Unfortunately, because you just don't know how to make it again and again. Fortunately, because, you know, nobody can copy it, right? Because there's no formula.
Absolutely.
So I like it the way it is.
Yeah. And it brings me to my next question, which is, you know, with so much uncertainty at the earlier stages and very limited data points to extrapolate and, you know, just foresee if the company will succeed or not, how do you balance between relying on your gut feeling, you know, just meeting the founders versus a data-driven, checklist-driven approach to make those decisions? How do you balance between these two?
Yeah, look, I think when a lot of people say, you know, early stage investing is an art, it's not a science and everything, I think what gets missed often is that when you say it's an art, you're not saying that it is not a science, right? You're just saying that, look, that checklist is automatically happening in our heads at scale, super fast. Yes, 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 no, 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 yes, 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 no, 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 right? And then you're saying, okay, I get it, this passes the next step, right? So I think for investors who are doing it with crazy level of intent and feedback and calibration, I think there is a checklist that is always happening, correct? Every call it is happening, in fact, right? But the gut and the art is layered on top of it, which is where I think the qualitativeness of it comes. Mm-hmm. And I think when I am investing at the earlier stages, let's say Teachmint, I invested when founders were still in their, you know, notice period. And I still committed literally on the first call, and I can't be more sure of any other company. I know what we are building. We are, you know, like Stripe is building the infrastructure for commerce. Teachmint is building the infrastructure layer for education. Any teacher, any subject, any language, any device, anywhere. Correct. So I think it's a large vision, and I have never looked back because it was, I think I was convinced of the market, and I think we just had incredible alignment with the team. So when that happens, you know, the art and the gut kicks in, but the checklist has already happened, right? So you're not like taking emotional calls. where you were going to end up with buyer's remorse, thinking, oh man, I think I forgot to figure out how they're going to ever make money or something like that. So something to that effect, right? It's a very hard one because I myself cannot replicate the scenario with a deal after deal, right? Because every deal is different. Every situation is different. Where they are in the fundraising cycle is different. Everything is different. So, but I think that's the fun of it, honestly.
Absolutely. And it's a very interesting way to describe the art and science of, you know, early stage investing. And, you know, not all investors will be willing to invest that early and be willing to take that kind of gut call. So what can founders do at those early stages to make the job for an investor, you know, easy, whether it's a yes, whether it's a no, just make it easy for them to make that decision early on?
Yeah. So look, I think what founders are not doing at scale is they're not understanding what they actually need to do. They're pitching at the earliest stages when they have very little, and they are pitching and pitching and pitching, right? Whereas I think what I would do is I would first explain what I'm doing, but as I am doing every slide after the what is it that I am doing, I'm actually conveying how I am reducing risk. Here's my team. Here are the next 10 people who are going to join us. I'm reducing people risk. I'm telling you, not only am I good, I can actually attract really good people to come behind me. Market risk. How am I explaining that, hey, you know, this is real. Here are the 5 reasons. Here's what we validated. Here are surveys. I mean, it's amazing how little survey data I see from founders. Oh, we've talked. Yeah, you've talked. I just don't know if you talked to 5 people or 500. What did you find out? What did they say? Why did you? I mean, these numbers are great, right? Because I can find a report to give me fancy numbers for any market, right? But how accessible is that? How real is it? How much is it happening now? That is the risk reduction around market. And then risk reduction around product itself. Are you pitching or are you building as well? Because I worry with teams who are not building. You have to build. You have to have an MVP live. Show me. I don't care that whether your app looks great, what people are saying. I just want to see that you are not waiting for somebody else to give you money to start building. Correct? So you are reducing product and traction risk, because the moment, if you are a smart team, you know what you're doing. When you actually build and push something live, you'll get data. And most likely that data is going to prove your hypothesis. And that some data is going to be more than me just believing how cool you are and why I should believe in you. So these are examples of how you want to have a deck where beyond establishing what it is that you're doing, you want to educate me why I am reducing risk systematically. And I think that's one of the most important things. The other important thing is, if you look at every unicorn today, everybody who is raising capital today, assuming as a founder, you've taken the venture capital route, you know that majority of them, not all, okay, but a good majority of them are excellent storytellers. They can paint the vision of what it is that they are doing. Why are they doing it? What is the mission and why is it world changing? And I think that clarity can start from day zero. If you look at Aditi of Local, Ajinkya of Growfix, Aditya and Raj of Stoa School, Prasanna of Guide, these guys are already telling their story. Don't wait for somebody else to give you credibility or some external validation. I don't want that. I'd love to see founders who believe that money is a means to an end. I know what the heck I'm doing. I'm really proud of it and I am going to wear it on my sleeve. You know, heck, I wear my portfolio on my sleeve. Why is that? Because I'm very sure of what we are doing. We'll fail. You know, look, out of so many companies, we'll succeed many times. We will fail many times. But even when we fail, we would have paved way for the next guy or gal who gets it right. Correct? So tell your story and don't wait for your Series D to start feeling comfortable to tell your story. Start from, you know, before you take a check from me.
So great points. And, you know, the point about conviction and storytelling, it is not just convincing, you know, the investor on the other side. It's helping you evolve and, you know, just validate your story to yourself, adding to that confidence for you to continue building towards the vision that you started with.
Exactly.
I want to talk about the next stage from here on, which is scaling up. And, you know, early on, quality of founders is, of course, one of the most important elements that defines the potential for a startup success. But the team that you form around you as a founder, it's equally important in scaling up the startup and increasing the probability of that success. But however, not everyone in that team might be as passionate and driven as the founders themselves. So the question is, how can founders ensure they pass on that kind of energy, drive, and passion to the early members of the team that they're hiring? And broadly, how do they transform individual capabilities into institutional capabilities?
So that's a great question. And look, honestly, I don't know if there is a right answer to it. Look, I think let's just think about what motivates people, right? Majority of the times, depending on what kind of a person you are, and let's say you and me are good people and we have ethical boundaries and we are trying to build something, we're giving it our lives, we're the founders of a company, right? We are sort of coming together around something that is more than, oh, we sold $100,000 of some software this month, right? I think that is very hard to build motivation around. You want to say, look, we are changing the way millions of Indians are studying today. We are changing the dynamics around MBAs. At Stoa School, we are doing that. And I'm giving you these examples because I know how we are kind of creating sort of that sense of mission, which will help us build a 10 and 20 year company. So I think as you sort of build the core of these things, there is sort of a sense of mission around which you can rally your first one hire, your first 10, 20, and 100 hires, right? So I think that is the sense of mission. And I think when I say a sense of mission, you can always say, oh, we want to be the largest CRM company in the world. I don't think that is a mission. I think you want to say, we want to make something easier, cheaper, affordable, improve lives, and things like that, right? So I think companies that have done that very well have been able to really attract a set of people that have not come there because they wanted to work for a startup. They've come there to be part of that mission. So I think I'm just sort of giving you a very long-winded answer because, again, it's a little hard to explain. I could say, okay, have a mission, but it also means what mission is needs to be understood. When that is understood and clear, then I think you're able to build a team. Once you do that, I think that foundation goes a long way, by the way.
Absolutely.
So if at Ravish at Khata Book, he's not building a ledger for shopkeepers, right? He's changing the way micro entrepreneurs in India perform work. He is saving hours, improving cash flow. And the entire Khata Book story is about just uplifting the way micro entrepreneurs in India work and live and gain from what they are giving to their businesses, right? Digitizing them is going to be just incredible impact that we'll start to see slowly, but it will just be very, very deep, right? So when you have a sense of that mission, I think, you know, you can attract some people who are looking to work hard. You know, when you put all of that together, I think most good founders will be able to rally a troop for a very long time.
Yeah, and it's like you said, it's very important to not just have that sense of mission, but to be able to communicate that to the team and constantly nurture that mission and the communication around that mission as you scale up. And then you'll be able to rally, a strong team and get the right talent to come and join your startup and join the mission that you are on to.
Absolutely.
So just talking along the lines of scaling up, there's a long run debate about whether you should bootstrap or whether you should raise funds, you know, as you scale up. There are pros and cons and everyone should know that. But I just want to talk about some nuances and downsides, you know, that you think a founder should be aware of if they are, you know, bootstrapping a business as they scale it.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I actually wrote about this a couple of months ago. I think the gist of it is very simple. Whether you're bootstrapping or you're going the venture route, you're actually giving every ounce of your energy to a particular company for several years, sometimes, let's say, 5 years and 10 years. So I think the question I want to ask is, it is not about raising funding or not. It is not about bootstrapping or not. It is about you are giving 10 years to a company that you're excited about. you're excited about the opportunity, you are pretty much giving everything you have to it. So if you're doing that, then my question is, do you want to unlock the entire potential that can be unlocked, right? Now, if the answer to that is yes, then you have to say, if I have to raise money to unlock that potential, then I'll raise money. So it is never a bootstrapping or venture route as an argument. It is about, hey, you know, if I'm going through 10 years of this journey, do I want to actually give it the best and unlock everything that is possible? So that's the only question I think people should ask. And I think 9 out of 10 times, most people who've gone through at least an experience of 2 will clearly understand that unlocking is the answer. Right? It will tell them that it is not about upsides or downsides of bootstrapping or a venture. It is about choosing the path that will get the largest return on time spent, effort spent, and whatnot.
Yeah, agreed. I think that's a very interesting way to, you know, put this in context. And of course, while the debate can go on, it's more situational. Founders can figure that out. But like you rightly said, if you're going all in, try to unlock the maximum potential that you can.
Exactly.
So, you know, I want to talk about the role of investors, right? You know, as a company starting up, from your experience, you know, what are the specific areas that founders should definitely seek help from their investors to ensure they get, you know, their A, B, C things right as they're scaling up during their journey?
So I think investors are on the same journey as you. They believe in the same vision, mission. They believe in you. They believe in the team and the opportunity and everything that you are doing, right? But they are not building with you, correct? And to a certain extent, you could say that, Vaibhav, you love us, but you love 80 other companies as well. So I think you have to be very clear that investors are building their firm like you are building yours, right? But they are probably your closest well-wishers. Now, once that is done, and I'm assuming that you have chosen your investors very carefully, right? And that is something that I would advise as well, because I think it's common sense, it's a cliche, you're getting married and whatnot, right? But how many times have we come across missing alignment? Correct. So I think once you've chosen that, then I think just consider them as your well-wishers who will motivate you when you are down, who will correct you when they think something is not right. And it is a relationship that actually thrives through good times and bad times, right? That has to be the nature. So before how you work with them, you have to establish how you feel around them, how they feel around you. And I think for me, that is the most important, right? Because if I don't get that chemistry right, I just don't know how to help you. And if I don't see that coming back from you, the comfort, then I don't feel motivated to, you know, keep going, correct? So I think get that right, number one, right? And after that, you'll be amazed that if you get that right, then it just becomes natural. It is not about how you use your investors. It will just all happen, right? You will know who's what. They are feeding you this. You are asking, hey, what do I do about this? So I think they're just your well-wishers, but they are coaches, right? To treat them as coaches who will, you know, not play the game. They are on the sidelines, but they can figure out what's going on. They can tell you what's missing when something is missing, right? So get the relationship right. And after that, let it be free flowing, right? Depending on who's on your cap table. And let it not be I'll update you once a month. I think that basically goes back to the fact that the relationship is not right in the first place, correct? And then it will be like, you know, very just continuous. It's like brainstorming, helping, nudging, asking, saying, telling. And that's why, you know, you have people who say, you know, I talk to my founders at 2 a.m. in the night and I'm just so kicked, I can't go to sleep. That kind of a thing, right? I think you should seek that. Not always easy, may not always happen, but I think that's what I think goes the longest way, because then there is trust, right? And when there is trust, then things happen.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting way to put it. And Vaibhav, you've been an operator yourself. You spoke about, you know, the 2 entrepreneurial experiences that you've had. So tell me, just to summarize, you know, what are the key learnings that you've had while building businesses, you know, in your entrepreneurial journey?
So I think the biggest learning is about leverage. As a founder, you want to constantly build leverage for yourself. And leverage comes from revenue, leverage comes from customers, leverage comes from reviews on G2 Crowd, leverage comes from people who want to join you, leverage comes from all these things, right? Because that leverage essentially helps you to build a stronger and stronger foundation, right? So whether you are bootstrapping your company or you have raised capital, you literally, like I was telling you about risk, right? So when you're raising and pitching, you're saying, this is how I reduce risk. Where if I'm building, the only single most word I will use is leverage, right? I want to continuously build leverage. And leverage is not like, oh, I added 2 months of runway. No, leverage is that, look, I added 12 months of runway, or this is, sustaining itself and growing. I don't have to worry about it. So leverage is all about just that, something that just keeps strengthening your business. Risk aversion was just telling investors how this will not fail. But leverage is about that, hey, this is how this is not failing, but growing stronger.
Yep. Surviving versus putting yourself in the driver's seat.
Exactly. Right. And I think when that happens, you sort of know what is important versus urgent, and everything falls in place, right? So if you just apply leverage to everything, is this thing going to give me leverage? Has this increased my leverage? What will this do to my leverage? And so on and so forth, right? Because leverage is just applicable to everything, and it just makes everything easier. So as a team, if you're trying to make a decision, you ask a simple question, what does this do to my leverage, right? So I think that's probably one single omni-applicable takeaway that I think works for me even today.
Awesome. Webber, I want to shift gears here and, talk about micro VCs and angel investors. What are some common missteps that you've observed from first-time angel investors when they're starting out investing in startups?
So, I've been investing for a while, and I think there are a lot of people who've invested for a longer time as well, right? But when I speak to, we have a lot of investors and LPs who invest with us, and angel investors that I've spoken to over a period of time. And I think understanding the asset class, how it behaves, and what matters, right? Those are the three most important things. So what is the asset class, right, that you're investing in? When you're saying angel, that means obviously you're going at the earlier stages. So you just have to understand that, boss, this is 100% risk. If you put a dollar, put it only if you are ready to lose that entire dollar. That's number one. No matter what, that's what you want to think as an angel investor before you invest anything. I don't think people generally go and do 100% risk investments in their lives, right? So I think this has to be hammered very well. Now, after you say that, then you say, look, like all startups don't fail, all angel investments don't fail either, right? So then you apply the same risk reduction and say that this is how I want to understand this asset class, that I'm going to invest with the understanding that I can lose my entire capital. However, when I make a decision to choose to invest in a particular company, I am going through a checklist where I'm saying, oh, this is better, so the risk is lower. This is good, so the risk is lower, and so on and so forth. And then whatever passes through that, you build comfort and you do more, you calibrate, you learn, and that's how it goes. Now, the challenge is you don't kind of put 100% risk at the top first. You sort of are already trying to find something that is safer. And the moment you want to try and find something safer, that is exactly where mistake starts to happen. No angel investor in the world has ever made money by making safe investments, because venture, by the nature of it, does not stand for safe. It's the exact opposite. So I think that's kind of something that I feel a lot of people nod at, but very few people internalize. So I think that's number one. Number two is understanding the fact that irrespective of how many companies get funded from different types of investors, it's the top 3, 5, 7% companies that actually make money in venture. Which means that once you have said that, yes, I will invest irrespective of all of these risks, you have to say, now, what should I invest in? That is where I think the question around access comes in, right? If you're just starting and nobody knows you and you just think, I want to invest, most likely you're going to come across companies that you should not invest in, right? So accessing or finding a way to get onto the best cap tables is the second most important thing to do. And there are a number of ways to do it if you want to figure out how it works, right? And then once you figure out those two things, then you sort of, you know, build your model, right? Some people will do a fixed check size across many investments. Some people will do smaller number, but larger check size. And I think that, I don't think there is one right answer, but there's a lot written around it, right? So I think people just have to internalize what works for them.
No, I think that's great advice, especially with so many new angel investors and micro VCs, you know, popping up as we evolve as an ecosystem in India. And just, you know, double clicking on the second point that you mentioned about access, capital today is, you know, getting commoditized and it's abundant and available. What founders are focusing on is how do I get maximum, you know, value per dollar invested? So as a first-time angel investor or someone who's just starting out, how do I build that credibility or how do I start adding value, you know, without having a portfolio to show, you know, my track record as an angel investor?
So you do what the founders do, right? So you tell your story, right? You choose a platform, you write, you say what you stand for, investor, you're in it. There's just no shortcut to it, right? If you actually are going to bring something more than money, then the best way to do it is make people believe through what you do instead of what you say. And the bar is extremely low for it, right? So I think I would do that in today's environment, whether it's Twitter or LinkedIn, or choose your platform, see what you're comfortable with, say, you know, what you're learning, what you're looking for, what have been the experiences, what are you connecting the dots around, and things like that. I think that goes a long way.
Amazing. So, you know, moving on to our final segment, which is the rapid fire, Vaibhav, I'll ask some questions and, you know, hope to get your immediate honest thoughts on the same.
Sure. I'm terrible at answering in short, as you can see. So, but yeah. But let's do it.
Okay. First one. One thing that you'd like to change to improve the state of the Indian startup ecosystem.
Oh, that's simple. More money.
More capital.
More capital. More capital. I think we are honestly super underserved in terms of capital. We are also super underserved in terms of more viewpoints, more investors who will support a wide range of companies that our founders are building, right? So we just need more investors and more capital.
The most unusual memorable pitch meeting that you had with the founder?
That's another simple one. Sumit Maniar of Rupeek. I actually looked at Sumit's deck in the very first round. This was, I think, when we were doing Better Capital personal checks only, not as a fund. And I said, gold loans, gold loans, gold loans. I don't understand anything. I am a tech guy. I just came back from SF. This is not what I'm looking for, right? But I think for some reason, Sumit reached out and he said, hey, if you're in Bangalore next, I'd love to catch up and this and that, right? So I was actually going to be in Bangalore the next week. I had a late night flight back to Pune and I said, hey, come by, right? So we met at the ITC Gardenia and like a 30 minute went to 2 hours maybe or something like that. And he explained me everything. And at the end of it, I said, okay, so what you're actually doing is you are actually reimagining the front end of asset-backed lending, starting with gold loans. That's the product you're building. He said, yes. And I'm like, why doesn't your deck say that? So he said, well, that's another story. But, you know, his rounded close, that was a Friday night. Monday morning, he called me and he said, this is the only remaining check I can take. And I wired it. It remains one of my best investments. And I give 100% of the credit to Sumit and that meeting.
Amazing. Great story. If you had to give a TED talk, what topic would you choose and why?
I think I would try to talk about what we are actually doing it better, right? Which is, you know, 80 companies are 80 missions for us, right? So I feel that we need a lot more mission-orientedness in the world. And we need a lot of action behind that mission-orientedness, right? So I just don't want to say, oh, I support climate change. I don't want to say I support education for girls. I don't want to say I want to be unbiased against women. I want to do it. You won't believe, but we have the largest number of women founders potentially as a percentage in our portfolio. We have all women founder teams. We have husband-wife teams. And I think that's what I would want to talk about, you know, having a mission and an action plan around it. Because when we turn all those missions at scale into action, I think just enormous magic can happen. So I think that would be something that is always top of mind for me.
I'm sure that TED Talk will be very impactful and very inspiring whenever we get to hear the complete version of that. Thanks for saying that. Vaibhav, this has been, you know, an amazing conversation and a privilege to host you. Before we sign off, any final thoughts for, you know, current and aspiring founders who are listening to this podcast?
I think I have to say to every single founder, however small, large, big, raising, not raising, bootstrapping, I just want to say that what they are doing is incredibly powerful, because whether you're a 2-person company or a 2,000-person company, you are doing something that very few people in the world end up doing. There is a large number of people that you and I would know who want to do it. So I just have tremendous respect for anybody who is a founder. And I want to say kudos. I want to say keep doing and good luck. And hopefully I get to meet some of them and help some of them along the way. But just incredibly powerful thing to do is what the founders are doing, right? So entrepreneurship is a way of life for me. And I can't respect these founders anymore. Just absolutely love it.
Beautiful. Beautiful, Vaibhav. I think that's a perfect note to end our conversation today. Thank you so much for taking out the time. And it was amazing to have you on the show today.
Thanks so much, Digjay. And I'm glad we are doing this today. So thank you for this lovely conversation.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of the VC Bruner podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please let our guests know about it. Share your thoughts on social media and let them know what were your key takeaways. We would truly appreciate if you could subscribe to our podcast on the podcast platform of your choice and leave us a review on Apple iTunes. This will help others discover the podcast. To get insights and to learn more about startups and venture capital, you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram. We will love to hear from you there. You can find all episodes together on our website, thevcpreneur.com. We will be back again next week with another VCpreneur that is making a dent in the venture universe. Until then, take care and keep shining.